11 hours Greenwich Mean Time. This is News Desk in the World Service of the BBC with David Legg. The headlines: rockets have been fired from Lebanon into northern Galilee, the first such attack on a populated area of Israel for more than a year. There's been a mixed response to a national strike in Kenya called to press for political reform. Two senior officials in China have been sentenced to long terms of imprisonment for corruption. The American special envoy Richard Holbrooke has been meeting the Bosnian Serb president Biljana Plavšić, who is locked in a power struggle with the supporters of her predecessor. Also in this programme, the latest from the test match between England and Australia. Israel says rockets have been fired into one of its towns from inside southern Lebanon on the northern Galilee region. It's the first attack on a populated area in Israel since April last year, when the Israeli government and the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah agreed to avoid targeting residential areas. The Israelis have blamed Hezbollah for the latest attack, although a spokesman for the group has denied responsibility. Here's our Jerusalem correspondent, Lise Doucette.
A salvo of three rockets landed before first light in the center of the Israeli town of Kiryat Shimona. A synagogue took a direct hit, leaving some of its walls punctured by large holes. One woman was lightly injured from shards of glass. The Israeli army ordered residents into bomb shelters and reinforced security rooms in case another attack followed. It's the first time an Israeli town has been hit since Israel and the Lebanese Hezbollah group reached a ceasefire understanding last year not to hit civilian areas. Hezbollah has been threatening to attack Israel after an Israeli commando attack and air raids deep into Lebanon earlier this week. But a Hezbollah spokesman said its fighters did not fire rockets into northern Israel this morning. Israeli government sources say this may be an indication that Hezbollah wishes to avoid any further escalation. Tensions have mounted all this week. Israeli security chiefs have warned Hezbollah against any cross-border strikes, but they've also emphasized Israel's desire to calm the situation. Israel, which occupies a 15-kilometer band inside Lebanon, has long been locked in a low-intensity conflict with Hezbollah fighters. Last year, Israel launched a 17-day onslaught in which some 200 people, mainly Lebanese civilians, were killed.
Lise Doucette. The Israeli army has lifted some of the restrictions imposed on the Palestinians after the bombing of a Jewish market in Jerusalem last week. The blockade of two West Bank towns has been lifted, and some of the restrictions imposed at the Allenby Bridge crossing between the West Bank and Jordan have been eased. But the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has said other measures will remain in force until the Palestinian Authority takes concerted action against Israel's militant opponents. From Jerusalem, Raghi Omar reports.
Trucks carrying essential foodstuffs and medicines began traveling into Gaza from the Karni crossing points in large numbers from early in the morning. At least 300 are waiting to make the journey. A spokesman for the Israeli coordinator in the West Bank and Gaza Strip told the BBC that allowing the supplies to get through to Gaza was a humanitarian gesture and was aimed at countering strong Palestinian criticism that the closure was having a devastating effect on food supplies and the health services in Gaza. Furthermore, the Israeli army has slightly eased travel restrictions between the West Bank towns of Nablus and Jericho. The Israeli government spokesman David Bailan said the moves were part of what he described as a sliding scale policy, saying that the easing of the Israeli closure would be taken in correlation to increased Palestinian security measures against militant Islamic groups. Although these are limited steps, they represent a noticeable change in Israeli attitudes from 1 week ago in the wake of the bomb attacks in Jerusalem, when Israeli officials adamantly refused to relax the closure or resume talks unless the Palestinians took strenuous measures against militant groups. The talk now seems to be of reciprocal measures.
Raghi Omar. President Saddam Hussein of Iraq has strongly criticized Iran for persisting in what he calls a hostile policy towards Baghdad. In a speech marking the 9th anniversary of the end of the war between the two countries, the Iraqi leader said relations with Iran would not improve until the Iranians honored their commitments to Iraq. This was the first formal Iraqi reaction to the election of the new Iranian president, Mohammad Khatami, a relatively moderate cleric who took office promising peace and security in Iran's relations with other countries. Our correspondent Barbara Plett reports.
Saddam Hussein urged Iran's new president to resolve issues that continue to strain relations between the two countries. He urged Tehran to free Iraqi prisoners captured during the 8-year Iran-Iraq war. He also demanded the return of several aircraft that Baghdad flew to Iran to escape bombing during the 1991 Gulf War over Kuwait. Saddam Hussein said Iraq would not be content to see its neighbor merely replacing one president with another, unless that change was accompanied by a shift in policy from one of expansion and interference to one of cooperation. The issue of prisoners of war has long been a source of contention. Iran denies that it still holds Iraqi POWs, although the Red Cross says more than 13,000 have not yet been returned. Both governments also accuse the other of supporting rebel groups bent on overthrowing them. Saddam Hussein's tough response to Iran's new president contrasted with the reaction of other Arab Gulf countries, long suspicious of their Persian neighbor's revolutionary brand of Islam. They welcomed the election of Mohammad Khatami as a step towards more stable ties. Iraqi newspapers have said Mr. Khatami will not be able to influence the country's foreign policy, since hardline religious leaders have the final word on such matters.
Barbara Pletch reporting from Cairo. A nationwide one-day strike is taking place in Kenya, called by opposition activists seeking political reform. Many shops and businesses are closed, and traffic in the capital, Nairobi, is much lighter than usual. But many public employees arrived for work, saying they feared they'd lose their jobs if they obeyed the strike. The government has described the stoppage as unlawful, but so far the security forces have not intervened. The strike organizers have been addressing workers at a rally in Nairobi, from where Kathy Jenkins reports.
Many workers in Kenya's large centers have responded to the call for a one-day stoppage. Shops and businesses in the capital have remained closed, and the situation is reported to be similar in other large centers, including the port of Mombasa. Strike organizers and opposition leaders have been addressing workers who have gathered in Nairobi's Central Park, shouting now familiar slogans for constitutional reform. For many present, the demand for reform has become synonymous with the desire to see the end of President Moi's rule and the impoverishment which is associated with it. The security forces are visible in the capital, but they have kept in the background. Last month, suppression of opposition demonstrations was extremely damaging for the Kenyan government, and there appears to be a wish to avoid a repeat of the violence. Public employees have been reporting for work, and government offices are functioning. Public employees were told bluntly that the strike was illegal and that they risked losing their jobs if they supported it. The Kenyan Association of Manufacturers reported that manufacturing plants were working normally. However, the industrial areas of Nairobi are far quieter than normal, indicating that at least some employees have stayed away.
Kathy Jenkins in Nairobi. As the Central Asian Republic of Turkmenistan tries to extract the maximum profit from its natural resources, one of the hurdles facing it has been its relationship with Russia. Turkmenistan has potentially vast amounts of natural gas to sell, but this has until now passed down a single pipeline over which the Russians have complete control. The Turkmen president, Sepahmurat Niyazov, has been in Moscow trying to ease that control to his country's advantage. But as Monica Whitlock reports, Turkmenistan may soon have a new outlet for its gas.
Turkmenistan could be a world-class player on the energy market with immense reserves of gas beneath its desert floor. But President Niyazov has stopped all exports because the only pipeline runs through Russia and Moscow has blocked Turkmen gas from the open market. Mr. Niyazov's visit failed to break the deadlock. He said the Russians refused to change their position. Bad news both for Turkmenistan and the foreign companies scrambling to do business there. But there are also signs that Russia's monopoly may be under threat. The Turkmen have announced that a new pipeline to Iran is almost complete, the first stage in an export deal with Turkey, an important market Russia wants to corner. The route has even won support from the United States, strengthening the Turkmen's hand. It's yet another indication that Moscow's former colonies around the Caspian are going their own way.
Our Central Asia correspondent, Monica Whitlock. The Turkish parliament has defied President Süleyman Demirel and ordered all casinos to close within 6 months. The president had earlier vetoed the measure on the grounds that tourism and jobs would be affected. Some estimates say the casinos are worth $2 billion a year to the Turkish economy and employ 17,000 people. But the new, more secular government pursued the legislation, which had originated under the previous Islamist-led authorities. The authorities argue that casinos are linked to organized crime. Last year, several casino owners were killed in mafia fighting. The president of Argentina, Carlos Menem, is in Chile for a visit that's intended to improve cooperation between the two countries. One of the most interesting aspects of Mr. Menem's visit is the prospect of joint defense exercises between Chile and Argentina due to take place early next year. But the issue of military cooperation is worrying some members of the Chilean armed forces, as Richard Collings reports.
President Menem's visit was timed to coincide with the inauguration of a massive gas pipeline between the two countries. For the first time, Argentina will supply cheap natural gas to one of Santiago's poorer suburbs. The project, which took almost 2 years to complete, is a further sign that economic cooperation between the two countries is growing. Chile is also one of the largest foreign investors in Argentina. But it's the question of military cooperation that's on most people's minds. Last week, the two countries announced they would be taking part in joint military exercises at the beginning of next year. Exact details have yet to be revealed, but General Pinochet, head of Chile's armed forces, and his Argentine counterpart have been meeting in Santiago to discuss the maneuvers. There's also talk that one day both armed forces might be merged into one as economic integration advances. But that's unlikely in the short term. Recently, leading members of Chile's armed forces have been preoccupied by the activities of a North American businessman. The environmentalist Douglas Tompkins has bought up large parts of land in the south of the country. The fear of the military is that the land might one day be sold to Argentina, giving it access to the Pacific Ocean. If that were to happen, the two countries would almost certainly be drawn into a complicated territorial dispute. It's a possibility that's led some parts of Chile's army to publicly urge the government to remain cautious over closer military relations.
Richard Collings in Chile. The health ministry in Cuba has said that an economic embargo by the United States has helped to keep the level of AIDS on the island relatively low. A health ministry official, speaking at an AIDS conference in Havana, said the American measures, which have been in place for 30 years, had ironically helped Cuba contain the illness. Our correspondent Tom Gibb sent this report from the Cuban capital, Havana.
The deputy director of Cuba's Tropical Medicine Institute, Jorge Perez, said the island's isolation in part explains why the authorities have been able to keep levels of infection to one of the lowest in the world. This contrasts with other Caribbean countries where AIDS is spreading out of control. In Cuba, there was mass compulsory testing, and all those found HIV positive were isolated in sanatoriums. The policy has now been relaxed, in part because of international criticism, in part because of the costs. Experts fear Cuba's drastic policy may have only slowed the spread of AIDS down. The rate of new HIV cases has doubled since last year. Studies show that most Cubans have multiple relationships and don't use condoms. The authorities and some international agencies are now looking to start a mass education program among young people where there's little knowledge of the risks.
Tom Gibb in Havana. Reports from the Caribbean say the volcano on the British-dependent territory of Montserrat has erupted again. The eruption, the latest of several this week, sent lava flowing down the side of the Soufrière Hills volcano. Officials on the nearby French-ruled island of Guadeloupe said scientific data suggested that volcanic activity on Montserrat would intensify in the coming days. Earlier, Britain said it was sending a government minister to Montserrat later this month. Since the volcano became active again 2 years ago, many of the island's inhabitants have left, and its main town, Plymouth, has been virtually destroyed. Police in Mexico say they've arrested the suspected ringleaders of a gang that smuggled deaf-mute people into the United States to work in servitude. The detainees, a father and son, who are themselves deaf and mute, were arrested in Mexico City after two other men were detained while trying to pay a large amount of cash into a bank. Last month, about 60 deaf and mute illegal Mexican immigrants were found in New York City, where they were peddling trinkets on the street and living crammed in two small apartments. The British government is considering legislation designed to stop people using Britain as a base to plan terrorist or other criminal activity abroad. Dissidents from many countries operate in London, and as our diplomatic correspondent Barnaby Mason reports, it can be difficult to draw a line in law between the voicing of legitimate political opposition and incitement of violence.
A number of governments have complained to Britain in the past few years about the noisy campaigns carried on against them by exiles in London, which has become a big centre for Middle East dissident activity in particular. Saudis, Bahrainis, Iraqis, Kurds, Iranians, as well as Sikhs and Sri Lankan Tamils, have all at times been the centre of attention. Any new legislation would not, presumably, be directed against mere expressions of dissent. Mr. Straw, the Home Secretary, says it would give British courts jurisdiction over acts of conspiracy or incitement in Britain which were related to criminal acts abroad. But defining what is a criminal act in, say, southern Lebanon or the West Bank or Gaza might be a problem, according to the Saudi dissident Mohammed al-Masri.
For example, if we go to the Hezbollah problem, which law should apply, Israeli law or Lebanese law? If we go to Palestinian problem, which law should be applied to Palestinian? Arafat is not a lawmaking authority. The courts will have a severe time, really, they are determining what's the applicable foreign law.
British Jewish leaders have raised the question of legislation again because of Israeli allegations that hard-line Palestinian groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad are channeling funds through London for terrorist attacks. This is another tricky area. It's difficult to prove that money raised by a branch of a guerrilla organization is intended to buy weapons or bombs rather than for legitimate charitable purposes. Above all, there's what's known as the Mandela question. Many would argue that any new law must not prevent a no struggle being carried on against the repressive regime.
Our diplomatic correspondent, Barnaby Mason. The Hungarian government is to consider plans to introduce new drugs laws in an effort to reduce the scale of drug abuse among young Hungarians. The Parliament's Anti-Drugs Commission is likely to recommend tougher limits on the quantity of drugs that can be defined as for personal use, and the establishment of a witness protection program to help police convict large-scale drug traffickers. Hungarian police and politicians say action is needed as the country is becoming increasingly important in European drug networks. You're listening to News Desk in the BBC World Service. It's now 10:23 GMT. On to the financial markets, and in London, the 100 share index is down 15 points to 50.72, while Tokyo's Nikkei average is up 128 to 19,604. Currencies, the dollar is worth 1 German mark 87 and 118 Japanese yen. The pound costs $1.57. The dispute between the head of the world governing body of football and the Brazilian sports minister, the former football player Pelé, has deepened. With more details and the latest news from the Ashes test at Trent Bridge, here's Gordon Farker.
The Brazilian president, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, has become involved in the row between Pelé and the FIFA president, João Havelange. Mr. Cardoso has given his full support to Pelé's proposals for a radical overhaul of the game in Brazil aimed at stamping out corruption. The plans include clauses that will allow referees to form independent commercial associations and will make all players free agents, no longer tied to clubs. João Havelange said that Pelé's bill contravened FIFA's rules and could lead to the expulsion of Brazil, the defending champions, from next year's World Cup finals in France. João Havelange is a Brazilian and his son-in-law is the head of the Brazilian Soccer Confederation, who'd lose much of their power under Pelé's proposals. Meanwhile, in Australia, FIFA is urging Soccer Australia to suspend the league's leading club, Sydney United, for taking the domestic governing body to court. Sydney United are taking legal action to prevent their suspension from the league because of continuing crowd trouble. FIFA's rules ban clubs from taking legal action against their national associations. Now on to cricket, and Australia only need to draw against England at Trent Bridge to secure the Ashes, and on the opening day, they went a long way to ensuring that. They resumed their first innings about 20 minutes ago at 302 for three. And for news of their progress, we can join Chris Florence at Trent Bridge.
Well, they've moved that score now on to 320 on another bright and sunny morning in front of another full house. But they have lost a wicket, though. Mark Waugh has been leg before to Andrew Caddick for 68 after adding 86 for the fourth wicket with his brother Mark Waugh to really endorse Australia's firm position. He was out, though, playing from the crease. The ball cut back into him and he was leg before, giving Caddick his second wicket of the innings and has really looked the best of the England bowlers this morning. Steve Waugh at the other end, he's 39 not out. He's now been joined by Ricky Ponting, who's on 8. And these two are looking to rebuild after the loss of that early wicket. But nevertheless, Australia firmly in control. They're 320 for 4.
And the World Athletics Championships continue in Athens today. Amongst the highlights should be the final of the men's 800 metres, where the Kenyan-born Dane Wilson Kipketer will be looking to break his own joint world record. Both the 200 metres finals will also be run today. Atto Bolden of Trinidad and Merlin Otte of Jamaica are the favourites.
Gordon Farker. The final report in this edition of Newsdesk is from Germany, where a major reform of the language has been under constant attack since two court rulings rejected moves to start teaching the new rules. When the reforms were unveiled last year, they were greeted with a mixture of confusion, ridicule and scorn. Now the campaign to reject them altogether is gathering pace. From Berlin, Mark James reports.
When representatives from Germany, Austria and Switzerland got together 10 years ago, their aim was to come up with a few new rules that would make German spelling and punctuation more logical, more user-friendly. When they finally presented their suggestions last year, they could not have expected such a passionate reaction from schoolteachers, writers and ordinary Germans. These are reforms, for example, that want to get rid of the H in Thunfisch, that's tuna fish. What did it for Gabriela Rutter was when her daughter came home from school and showed her the new way to spell sugar. Zucker, one word to German speakers for centuries, has now developed a hyphen between the ts and the k. Something had to be done, said Mrs. Rutter, and that something ended in victory in a court in Lower Saxony. The court said the new rules could not be introduced into schools in Lower Saxony. A court in the state of Hesse has passed a similar judgment. This, along with numerous petitions fighting the changes, has prompted the head of Parliament's Legal Affairs Committee to call for the reforms to be thrown out. Others, such as the Green Party, say that would be a step backwards, and publishers, who've already printed thousands of new school books, not surprisingly agree. The debate, though, will run and run, and Germany's parliament is due to have yet another look at the rules in October.
Mark James in Berlin. And at N News Desk, here again are the main points. Israel says there's been a Katyusha rocket attack on the northern Galilee region near the Lebanese border. The rockets, fired from southern Lebanon, damaged a synagogue and injured three people. Correspondents say it's the first such attack on a populated area since April last year. A delegation of more than 40 Israeli Arabs has begun an unprecedented political visit to Israel's long-standing enemy, Syria. The group, which includes several members of Israel's parliament, was invited by the Syrian president. A one-day national strike has begun in Kenya, despite a decision by the government to outlaw the action. Opposition groups are pressing for political reform and early elections. Two senior Chinese officials have been sentenced to long prison terms for accepting bribes. They are the latest victims of a government campaign against corruption. And the American official leading a new diplomatic mission in Bosnia-Herzegovina, Richard Holbrooke, is today due to see the Bosnian Serb president, Biljana Plavsic, and the Yugoslav federal president, Slobodan Milosevic. Those are the main points. This is David Legg, ending News Desk.